It is Saturday, August 16th, 2008, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today we cover the Week in Geek News, and the second half we'll invite you to join the program.
The bandwidth for GeekSpeak.org is provided by GNI, GNIHosting.com.
Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KUSP. This is GeekSpeak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks. Miles Elam, student, programmer, and political junkie. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
Ben Jaffe, slacker and media dude.
Slacker?
Sure.
Morning.
Okay. And Ryder Brooks, support engineer at Sun Microsystems. Morning, Ryder.
Good morning.
How you doing?
I'm doing excellent.
Good. Well, let's start with you. Before we start taking calls in the second half, let's do some Week in Geek news, and I'll start with you, Ryder.
Okay. So the TSA, I believe it goes into effect today. Today's the 16th?
Yeah. Yes, it is.
They have a new checkpoint-friendly laptop bag policy where you can stop unpacking your laptop bag and if you have pre-approved bags. There's three primary types. There's the butterfly style, opens up in half, folds out three ways, or if you have, you know, with popular MacBook owners, the sleeve style, little neoprene. They are not allowing or accordion style or backpack style laptop bags. So
they're not allowing that type of bag?
They're not allowing for you to just plop it in the x-ray machine. So, and what you have to do is you have to unfold your laptop bag, but you don't have to take it out of the case any longer. They still reserve the right to screen your bag if it, for some reason,
take a peek at it,
you know, doesn't look right in the x-ray machine.
So it's not models. It's just a kind of models and makes. It's just the form.
Well, there's actually going to be a bunch of manufacturers that responded. Part of it is the type of materials that they use for the laptop bag that tend to be more transparent and visible for the x-ray machines.
So they're going to start selling bags that say security check ready. Yeah.
And there's some concern whether or not some manufacturers are just going to label it as such, even though it's not the case. So it'll be interesting to see if we actually see more slowdowns, more screenings as a result of this. It'll probably be a new round of retraining people going through the security checkpoints.
Mm-hmm.
But, for me, I'm all for it. You know, it's great because, you know, what I have to do now, I have to take my kid out of her roller stroller thing, take my shoes off, take my belt off, do it with my laptop, you know. So it's pretty arduous procedure.
So it'd be nice to not have to pull the laptop out and turn it on, just have it scanned.
It would definitely help.
Just have it x-rayed, yeah. And there's no danger to a machine, a laptop being x-rayed? Or through the x-ray machine?
Not that I'm aware of.
Right.
I think isn't the primary concern with x-ray machines is high-speed film, non-digital film. So.
Right. All right. Thank you, Ryder. Well, Mr. Jaffe, since you're in the middle there, go ahead.
Yeah, I want to talk a bit about the Olympics and how theatrical they are. To me, it's been interesting watching this year, more so than previous years going back. It's been increasing how much media is becoming
You were only like seven, right?
No.
Oh, sorry. Go on. There's been a lot of media about the Olympics.
I think
course.
I was
yes.
eight. No, but media is becoming a huge part of theater and events like the Olympics, which
example.
Are theatrical in nature. For example, the video coverage and the editing has been becoming more and more complex and just insane the amount of footage they have to go through, and the 3D graphics that they have are becoming more elaborate. And you know,
I'm gonna understand the title stuff like this Olympics,
yeah, the,
and
the
all
titles,
that stuff.
For example,
that's
and,
pretty, I mean, very you know, football type style, of,
yeah, exactly,
of sports kind of coverage.
But
that, I mean, that's a pretty common thing,
and,
I think,
and
for
instant replay and all that.
Yeah, but I did hear something like the Beijing Olympics gave footage to companies.
I'll get to that in a sec. But one thing that apparently happened is NBC changed the order of the countries as they were appearing, which from a technical perspective, and that makes sense from a ratings perspective, push the U.S. further back in the lineup so people watch for longer. But from an editing perspective, that's a huge feat. You know, I mean, every when people watch video, they know it's edited. But
you're talking about the proscenium, walking of the flags
in
with
fact,
Olympics.
I think there was actually a shot of the U.S. on the field before the U.S. was shown walking out.
Yeah.
And, you know, the perceptive people caught that.
And they did this only so that they'd hold on to more viewers in the U.S.?
I imagine that would be the incentive, yeah. But from an editing perspective, that's huge, you know, the turnaround time that they had to do this. And also every edit has to be completely imperceptible. Otherwise, you know, the game's up. People know.
Wait a second. How much delay, how much time do they have to do
this?
Well,
they had whatever between China and U.S., 8 hours, 12 hours?
Okay, that's a lot of time. You could do a lot.
It's,
that
well, yeah, sense. But I mean, think about how much footage they have as well.
That's true.
And you know, just having teams of editors working together to do all of this, but then having them not step on each other's toes with footage.
Yeah,
and everything.
I've always wondered what the order was. It random order? I mean, how do they decide what the real order is? And is this does it perceive to the U.S. audience as a slight to the U.S. for it to be later?
You mean for the Beijing procession?
Yeah, how do they decide?
Well, they use the Chinese characters for the representation for the country, and they counted the brush strokes, and then they did it in that order.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow. How did you know that off the top of your head?
I was watching it with some friends, and a couple of them are from China and Taiwan, so they were kind of well acquainted with
except for the U.S.
They actually did explain it during the show, but one of the people I know was actually, you know, going, oh, he was counting, and he was kind of predicting when the U.S. would turn up, you know.
And then it was very wrong because it got edited differently.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. Hmm. And, well, what else did they do?
Two more things that I definitely noticed. Well, one thing, I wasn't actually watching at this point, but a blue screen of death appeared on the ceiling during the opening ceremonies.
Like a Windows blue screen?
A Windows blue, you know, this computer needs to be shut down. Blah,
was it
blah,
Windows 98 or XP?
They were running XP instead of Vista, and they decided to go with XP because of worries about stability. And that makes a lot of sense from a theatrical perspective. You know, you use what you've used before and what you know works.
Yeah, sure.
Unless you have a really, really good reason to go forward.
But that a blue screen.
Especially with something that big. But, you know, I mean, things happen. And
well, you've done shows with a lot of media in them where you've got a whole bunch of Windows machines running or even Macintosh machines running. Have you ever blue screen?
Well, I have not. I did actually. I was running a show with a Mac which froze up and crashed, but I'd set the background desktop to just be a black JPEG, so no one saw anything.
Covered for
I was running multiple monitors, so I covered for it, and I was able to remotely.
Miles,
one thing to keep in mind though is that the vast majority of Windows blue screens are due to driver issues and that hardware
interaction. Yeah.
So the fact that they were using top of the line, you know, cutting edge hardware is
probably problematic.
It's going to have a direct impact.
That's a really good point, right? Because they had brand new machines for everything. It's like brand new building.
So it may not necessarily be XP, or if they use Vista, it wouldn't have mattered if the drivers had some glitch.
Who should we pick to blame it on? Like a chipset, like Intel or NVIDIA?
If you live on the bleeding edge, you're going to get cut. You know?
It's true. And though when they probably had that projector on a moving yoke that was DMX controlled and everything, so they had the ability to shut it off and you know, just shutter it down. But I mean, as you scale up shows like that, you get more and more things that you have to control, and ultimately you can only have one person who is at the board, you know. And so if you have something that's messed up like that and you've got all these people watching for it, they'll say, hey, this is messed up, you know, shut off this projector. And then they have to find which projector it is and figure out where it's pointing.
Well, how long was the screen showing? Does anyone know?
I'm not sure how long, but there were certainly a lot of pictures of it.
Okay,
it was during the open ceremony.
What's the last theatrical thing?
The last theatrical thing, which I found most interesting, is the fireworks show was semi-faked in that the fireworks actually went off at the stadium, but they spent a year creating a 55-second sequence of fireworks of the footprints going over the thing because they were worried about a helicopter pilot and safety with the fireworks going on. That's the reason
they
say.
What do you mean they were creating? So
they created a computer-generated sequence which they showed on television instead of real footage. So, but what I find most interesting about this is there were people in the stadiums, and there are these giant screens in the stadiums that they're watching all of this stuff on because, you know, they've got cameras with zoom lenses better than our eyes. And people were watching these screens and found themselves unknowingly watching a computer-generated sequence of the fireworks
heads.
That were happening above their heads. So
okay, wait. So you're saying that a digital house of some sort,
yeah,
for a year worked on a project to generate exactly what the fireworks would look like, mm-hmm. so that they could render it, so that mm-hmm. you wouldn't have to fly a helicopter.
Exactly.
In the smog-induced city,
Crystal Digital Technology of Beijing, and they say mission accomplished because no one knew, you know, no one knew until they said so.
So. Was this footage given to people beforehand?
Yeah, it was given to all the.
NBC and stuff knew that they had footage that was before the show.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it's like a network knowing that they're going to lip sync, you know, this artist or something.
But it's equivalent to here's some temple footage. We haven't done this yet, but here's some footage of that. That's creepy.
It is creepy, but really, you just got to think of it as a show. This is
the conspiracies people should be focusing on.
Oh, conspiracy.
The thing is,
whatever.
It's how much. I mean, do you tell the audience that that's happening? How do you know what's real?
Well, you don't. I mean, you know,
if you're watching NBC.
Back maybe 150 years ago in the Olympics, you know, it was pretty obvious that everything was real. You know, they couldn't just throw on a CGI fireworks show on television.
Thousand years ago, you didn't have the choice of a Speedo mm-hmm. to make the difference in a swimming match.
Oh, we'll get into that in a second. So, well, here's the thing. I remember when the NFL started airing footage with the downlines, whatever those are called.
Yeah.
What are those called?
The
first down, second down, those lines.
Yeah, the lines that you see on the football.
I don't know anything
stadium.
About football. Those lines that like so they have a panning camera and it's sitting still on the grass. And of course that's all done via computers. That's not really there. You don't see it when you're near
mm-hmm.
it.
Yeah,
the
lines
so,
fake.
Looks so accurate. In fact, they even alphaing it so you can see the hair through it, and the keying is perfect. And you're just like, what?
Usually it's perfect.
Yeah.
When you see it glitching out or
but
you
it's
see
one of those
a football
things
player
where
walk through
you just do not know what reality is when you're watching video anymore.
And it becomes so easy that you just completely suspend disbelief just by default, you know, and, mm-hmm. and you go to a football game and you don't see those lines and your first response is, where are the lines? I don't know where the first down line is, you know?
Well, see, I don't go to football games, so I solved that problem right there.
Neither do I.
Okay,
I guess
what about
I'm
speedos?
Speaking of that.
Miles, you mentioned speedos.
Well, the fact that there's a swimsuit made by Speedo that its sole purpose is to reduce turbulence when the human body goes through water. Our bodies are not completely rigid, and so you end up with this turbulence. I don't know. I guess I already said turbulence, but
sure, turbulence. Let's use it again.
Whereas if you have this Speedo, it takes those parts of your body and makes them more rigid. That meaning that you can go through the water without that vibration, without mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. turbulence being generated.
It essentially forms a girdle around your mm-hmm. waist as well,
and
well, not just your waist, but other parts of your body as well, along your legs. Mm-hmm. Well.
And
it's a full body suit.
It uses
suit.
Like a different material. It's seamless for the most part, so there's less resistance because there's no seams in the
suit. So the question
suits.
I have is, why do you mention Speedo? Aren't multiple companies provide this type of swimming wear?
No, this was NASA researched,
patented thing. So Speedo is the only one. So
Speedo brand, not just
so all
Speedo
the
Speedo generically,
have to
but
use
Speedo brand. Except that an odd thing when I was watching the swimming matches
for in China where it's Speeda. Because it's actually a company that's faking it. Because there's so much copyright infringement.
I forgot the gentleman's name. I'm going to get it for this one. But the gentleman who from the U.S. who won all those gold medals for swimming.
Spitz?
Gold. At any rate.
The new one.
He was not wearing the Speedo outfit that
Phelps,
people
Michael
were talking
Phelps.
About. He was actually wearing one that was a really low cut. So... who knows?
Wait, well,
maybe just his body is so rock hard.
He's just
at
amazing.
All points,
he doesn't
Well, he's definitely been wearing it in some of the events. I think depending on which you know, if he was doing a butterfly stroke, I don't think they wear him for the butterflies.
Okay,
it's becoming more and more.
But they
obvious.
Have a pants version too. I mean, it looks pretty distinctly Speedo, kind of the way that the materials patterned. So.
It's becoming more and more obvious that we're geeks as opposed to sports fans. Forgetting names.
Really? I don't know. It's been pretty captivating. I don't normally do the Olympics, but watching the swimming in specifically has been pretty captivating. And
all right. Well, let's go on to the next news story. Miles, go ahead.
So U.S. has been behind in broadband speeds from many other parts of the world. We've covered this story before. However, someone has actually run some of the numbers, seeing the rate at which our internet speed is improving. And they checked the rate from 2007 to 2008, how much we'd bumped up.
Yeah.
And what they found was that if we made that same speed bump from 2007 to 2008, you know,
continually
going along as a percentage, yeah, we would reach the current rate of broadband speeds in Japan in 100 years.
USA!
USA! Yeah, we're that far behind.
You're saying that if we keep on increasing, in 100 years, we'll be the speed that Japan currently is?
That's correct.
That's pitiful.
So the average download speed in Japan is 63 megabits a second.
What?
That's for the home.
I'm moving. Our house prices.
South Korea is at 49 megabits per second. Uh-huh. Finland's 21. Wow. France, 17. Canada, 7.6. And the median upload speed was just 435 kilobits per second.
You know, if they made broadband speed an Olympic sport, I'll bet we'd catch up very, very quickly.
However, I did forget to put in what the U.S. number was, which is we're at 2.3 megabits per second average. Japan is at 63. We're at 2.3.
And we're increasing slowly.
Yes.
I'm also wondering if that increase is not because of, I mean, I haven't seen an increase on actual throughput, but that the percentages of people that are on dial-up is decreasing all the time and people are moving to DSL, and so the rate is going higher.
Well, DSL is now price competitive with the dial-up. So the dial-up just isn't really worth it anymore in most cases.
So when we talk about in the Central Coast that, you know, if you can't get DSL and you've got to use some Wi-Fi coverage thing, and if you really want serious internet, you've got to go to Japan. That's the real answer.
Yeah,
how much do they pay, though? I wonder how much they pay for their internet.
From what I understand, it's competitive. Cheap. No one's going to pay enough for their internet connection they can't eat. I mean, and right now, a lot of folks
eat their internet connection. What are you talking about?
I know, but a lot of folks here are, you know, purchasing their internet connection and still a large chunk of their monthly budget. Like, you have rent, you mm-hmm. have your internet connection. It's something to keep track of. So it's not like we have it all that cheap. In fact, price per megabit, everyone else has it cheaper than we do.
Mm-hmm. Miles, we got another... a little bit more of the news section, and one of the stories I really want to get to, so I'm going to ask you to do the next one. That is about Nintendo.
Yes.
Okay.
Shigeru Miyamoto, who is the original game designer of Mario Brothers, of the Zelda series,
This is like the premier game designer in the world.
Yes,
really.
This is the guy.
Mario Brothers,
for Nintendo.
Zelda. What else has he got?
He also, because he was interested in getting more exercise, he designed the Wii Fit, which has been a hit on the Wii.
What is the Wii Fit?
It's an exercise routine where you're using to follow certain motions.
Really? Yeah. You use the Wii to do it?
Yeah.
So he made a video game so he could get in shape.
Yes.
That's a gamer.
Then he took up music lessons and then designed Wii Music.
What's his next hobby?
Exactly. And so Nintendo, as a result, is saying... has told him he is not allowed to discuss his hobbies publicly.
So if you see him fishing, put stock in fishing games.
Right, because any glimpse inside his head, this is quoting from the Business Times Online in the UK, any glimpse inside his head could be worth billions.
Very cool.
So he has a gag order.
He now has a gag order on describing his hobbies.
Yeah, talking about what his life is like.
We got
to
get him on. That'd be so much fun. So, what are your hobbies? I can't talk about it. No. So, the Wii Fit, that's a new one, definitely. But the Wii Music one, what's it called?
Wii Music.
Wii Music. There's other music games, so it's not like he was the first to generate that. It's just that his game, I mean,
These games are not necessarily going to be the ones that make the most money. Like, he didn't make Pac-Man, and Pac-Man's made a huge amount of money over the years.
But it's still unique, and it's still a good game.
And especially within the Nintendo universe, he has generated the franchises that have dominated on that platform.
I just saw some video samples of a game for PS3 and Xbox, which is called Braid. And what Braid is a puzzle game, which it uses... ability for you to control time, and it's like Super Mario Brothers. That's that style of game called a platform game, and it's very much like, I mean, there's even little guys that walk along, you have to jump on them, knock them down. It's pretty much like Super Mario Brothers, and then a lot of effects. It's done with kind of a painting style instead of a computer animation. It looks like somebody's painted it with oil paints or acrylics. And the game is puzzle-based. So you come on, you see a screen, and you have to get places. And you can split your character in two via time. A really fascinating game called Braid. Highly recommend taking a look at it on YouTube.
I know this is going to put me in a bad light, but when you said there was a game called Braid, I suddenly had this image of you have a Wiimote, and you're
trying to braid hair.
Showing how to French braid someone's hair. You know?
Awesome. Oh, that's sad, man. Speaking of which, you can Gwendolyn, my daughter's hair is long enough to braid, and if you need to practice braiding, I have no interest in that.
I'm just saying, when you said a game named Braid,
wait, I'm going to quote you on that. You have no interest in braiding hair?
None? Really, not really. Uh-huh. Now braiding cable, that's the good stuff.
You're such a geek. So Miles told me years ago when we were making cases, he's like, yeah, I used to do this professionally at Santa Cruz Electronics. So Miles actually used to work at Santa Cruz Electronics when he was in college. Before he dropped out.
And after, actually.
Oh, after you got... Oh, you didn't drop out. What was it called?
Yeah, I failed out.
Oh, you failed out. Okay. So Miles would work at Santa Cruz Electronics, and inside of the computer case was lots of wires. And he used to spend the time to actually braid the wires together so that the cables were all nice and clean.
When I started working at the company, I was just putting the cables in, and my manager was saying, no, you want to braid those so that they look nicer. And he was just thinking, tie them up, just... You know, loop them up a little bit just so they're not going all over the place. I took them literally.
And you braided them.
And I braided them. And he came back and went, oh, wait. I didn't mean.
What kind of cables? Because that time we were talking about parallel.
No. ATA these are the types that are going.
Braiding parallel ATA would be amazing.
You like rip all the cables apart and strip them down?
No. These are the type that go to the hard drive light, the LEDs on the front
case.
Right. Mm. That usually are in a bunch of different sizes, a bunch of different lengths, because back in the day, motherboards, one connector could be far away from another one. They couldn't put them in a single ribbon like they do today.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I would braid it, and my manager came back and goes, oh, I didn't mean that. I'm like, oh, I'm sorry. I started to undo it. He's like, no, it looks good.
If so you can't tell, you're listening to Geek Speak. I couldn't resist Wells. At Castle Cottage today, which is in half an hour, we're going to be airing the Cabrillo Festival Family Concert, which is a very cool concert. I think it's already happened. That's why we're airing it today. But it's this wonderful opportunity for the Cabrillo Music Festival to show families and kids and stuff the music of the day and explain it as well. So I highly recommend listening to that. That's at 11 o'clock in a half an hour on KUSP. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. That geek that was just speaking was Miles Elam. We also have Ben Jaffe and Ryder Brooks, and we are taking your calls with questions and comments about technology. We will answer anything you'd like. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, that's 476-2800. Or toll-free anywhere in the country, 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. You can, of course, podcast multiple shows from KUSP by going to kusp.org, including GeekSpeak. You can find GeekSpeak at geekspeak.org, provided by NPR. Thank them for podcasting us regularly. If you'd like to call us with questions and comments about technology, we welcome you to do so. You really can ask us anything you'd like. We know more than we think. We think we know more than we know? That sounded a little bit like we don't really know that much, but we think we do. Nothing?
Or we know a lot, but we don't think very much.
But I do know the phone numbers, and you can ask us and tease us if you'd like. 476-2800. Again, that's 476-2800. Or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800. That means it's toll-free. 655-KUSP, because you're listening to Central Coast Public Radio. My name's Lyle Troxell. We have Ben Jaffe, Ryder Brooks, and Miles Elam. Ryder, do you have another news story for us today, sir, while we wait for calls?
Yeah, we talk about a little bit of... apparently, if you have a tendency to crave fatty food, you may be able to blame it on a childhood illness. Preliminary results from the University of Florida in Gainesville suggested that some severe ear infections that are incurred in childhood can actually damage nerves that transmit signals from your tongue to your brain because they route by way of the ear canal area.
I had lots of ear problems as a child. That's why I'm obese. I thought it was because I was eating too much. Okay, go on. So what do those feedback things do?
So apparently there's a nerve on your on your tongue, tip of your tongue, that suppresses your when you eat food, it suppresses the gag instinct, and I guess the side effect to that is that it stimulates the way that food tastes and can make food more more pleasurable in sense. Mm-hmm. And so they're suggesting that people that have had excessive ear infections in childhood have somehow damaged this nerve, and it's causing more foods, particularly fatty foods, to be more pleasurable to you.
Are they is it treatable?
Not that I'm aware of. No.
Oh, well, thanks a lot, Ryder. We'll make sure that Don knows about that. I'll ask you. Actually, I think I'm going to ask Don next week about losing weight and everything. If you haven't had a chance to listen to Dr. Don, I'm assuming that would be because you're podcasting Geek Speak. But, you know, if you just happen to always wake up at 10, definitely take a look at Dr. Don. She's got an amazing medical program. Sometimes you feel a little lost, but hey, you're listening to Geek Speak, so you must feel lost all the time. The phone numbers to call us with questions and comments. There's nobody waiting. We can take anything you'd like. The 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can go to geekspeak.org and ask us questions there. Hey, a couple weeks ago, was it last week? I told everybody about this wonderful new thing called Jot.com that is this free service. It's kind of neat. And I decided that today we would actually give it a shot. I'm going to call it and record something for it, and it's going to email it to me, and you guys will be able to hear me making the phone call, I think. We'll see if this works. Here it is, calling Jot.com.
Who do you want to jot?
Myself.
Sorry, didn't get that. Who do you want to jot?
Myself.
Sorry, didn't get that. Who do you want to jot?
Oh, the mic's down here. Me.
Sorry, didn't get that.
It's going to be myself.
Who do you want to jot?
Myself.
Sorry, didn't get that.
Epic fail.
Myself.
Goodbye.
Awesome.
That was great. Oh, man.
I'm going to pay money for that.
All the time.
I did play with it this week. We got a listener that really liked it. He sent an email back and said
he really
liked it. So I checked it out because I totally missed the reference to it. And it's kind of cool, actually. It worked fine for me, actually, in my house on my cell phone with a really bad cell phone reception. So I don't know what's going on with your phone.
It doesn't work for radio, though.
what does it do?
It emails the text of your message to yourself.
So you can talk.
Other things. Not OCR. VCR.
Yeah. Not just that. It'll update social sites like Twitter, status. And it'll just take what you say word for word. Sometimes you have to spell the words out if they're, you know, complicated. Yeah. You can not only email to somebody, but you can SMS somebody.
And it's free.
It's free. Yeah. Well, yeah.
How do they make money?
Good idea. Good question. I have no idea.
I don't know yet. Maybe they're just making people addicted to it and then they're going to ask us later.
Because it's definitely costing them money because it's a toll-free number that you're dialing.
Yeah. I mean, it's not cheap. The service is quite incredible. In fact, it's so incredible that last week I failed miserably, pretty much like that, on air. And I still want to try to do this again on air because it's really kind of neat. We actually got somebody that actually participated in our forums to talk about it. And I wanted to give him a little bit of a shout out. But why don't we take another news? We're not getting calls today. I guess people are too scared of us. Yeah, go ahead, Ben.
No, we have one, I think.
Oh, go ahead. Oh, we do.
One call.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So I have to push the button is what you're saying. Mm. Well, Ben, who is this?
John from Santa Cruz.
Hey, John. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi. So I have a question about video upload sites. You know, there's so many sites like YouTube out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering what your guys' opinion is of how long they'll be around. So if people are uploading videos.
Good question.
And then those sites run out of money or venture capitalism or whatever, you know, what are they just going to close shop or you think they'll have other options? And I'll take my call off the air.
All right. Thank you.
Well, YouTube's owned by Google, so they have some pretty deep pockets.
I know that they're actually having a lot of trouble keeping it it's not making any money, basically. Mm-hmm. They're having a lot of trouble keeping themselves from losing money by running YouTube, actually.
Yeah, so what if they decide to turn it off? Or will they? And also, are those videos out there now? Now they exist more than anything else. Like they're more stable than I Love Lucy because so many people could potentially have
it. But I was also under the impression that Google bought YouTube not necessarily because YouTube is a great value because they already had Google Video, but rather to have more of the market and to keep specifically to keep Yahoo from getting it.
Mm-hmm. Huh.
So,
well, how stable is? I think you still need to keep your own videos. I would say you still should mm-hmm. keep them. I mean, one way to do this is go ahead and submit to like 5 of these sites, right? And one of them will exist. Also, you can still download videos. So it's very possible that if they were to go down, they would make it available. I would assume there is a lot of bandwidth and a lot of storage capacity in the world. And there's a site called archive.org, which has this mission to archive everything. And I would assume that if YouTube is – they might even be scraping YouTube and getting copies of the files. I'm not sure.
No, well, they don't archive streaming video or flash or –
Well,
some images,
they don't
right?
make those things publicly available. They still might,
they might
be archiving
be scraping them.
Yeah. For a long time, archive.org was just scraping and didn't have any public face to it until it had enough of a system to manage it.
But so. YouTube has been adding a few things recently, like commercial-like items or advertisements that pop up at the bottom of it.
Mm-hmm.
So that may end up being a source of revenue when they can figure out how to get the ad model working for it.
Well, also thinking about keeping your own videos versus not, I mean, quality-wise, you know, YouTube videos, even the higher quality YouTube videos are not going to even get close to the quality of whatever video you're sending them. You know, if you shoot your own video, even if it's HDV or something like that, you're still going to have great quality compared to a site like YouTube.
Oh, that's a good point. So keep the original.
Yeah, definitely keep the original because, you know, if you end up having to pull the original, if you have to end up pulling it to edit it again, it's going to be a pain in the, you know, butt.
Well, I agree, and I think that, but I think if someone wants to make a video available to the masses and then possibly erase it, they're pretty safe putting it on a site like YouTube. And if you want to be more safe, put it on 5 different video sites.
Mm-hmm. Well,
but I wouldn't be concerned about the company getting rid of the videos and them never being available anymore. I link to YouTube videos in logs and stuff all the time.
That and there's a lot of software for downloading the videos themselves. There's Miro. There's programs that are specifically say we make it easy for you to download YouTube videos.
There's even Grease Monkey scripts that do it.
Some will even convert them from FLVs to, DV streams even. DV streams are huge, and they'll let you download those.
All right, so I was talking about Jot just a moment ago, and the person that contacted us was actually Steve from our forums, posted a whole story about ChaCha, which is another site, and what they do is you get to ask them a question, anything you want, and it will answer that. And what I've heard about ChaCha, this is 1-800-224-2242. That's called ChaCha. You can get to it from geekspeak.org if you'd like to look at today's show. Anyway, ChaCha, I think, actually has a human person reading the question and then answering it. That's how they're able to do it. It's not a phone call. You text message them something, and then it text messages back saying, working on it, and then it will send back the message itself. And then, of course, there's also Google, and Google has a phone line, which is a free directory assistance for businesses. And they give you the address, and they'll dial a number for you. They give you the text number. They'll dial it for you. And they'll keep repeating the they'll keep repeating the name of it to you until you can write it down. And that's Google's 411 is 800-466-4411. And since it's free, it's a little cheaper for you.
Goog 411.
Oh, Goog 411?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, cool.
G-O-G.
800-GOOG.
800 Goog 411.
And then there's one more that he recommended. This one actually costs money, and I don't really know exactly why it's better or not. Oh, no, I see. It's free as well, but they throw an ad in the beginning of it. So it used to be really great, and now there's a lot of ads. And that is an 800-373-3411. In any case, I'll link to this great post from Steve on our forums on today's GeekSpeak episode. Today's GeekSpeak episode is, of course, the 16th of August. Another call. Ben, who do we got? Line 2.
Lenny? Lenny from Aptos?
Hi, Lenny. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello?
Hello. Who is this?
My name's Lenny.
Hi, Lenny. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Thank you. I have a network issue that I don't know. It may be too convoluted to really ask, but I have 3 desktops. Two hardwired to the router, 1 wireless,
mm-hmm.
and then when I and they're all going, and then when I walk in and open my laptop and boot, one of the hardwired computers gets IP conflict error.
Ah, that's a nice classic networking problem. Okay.
And then the other two who share a networked program, the program's resident on one of the computers and the other one shares it. The one that shares it loses
connection. So this is a real classic network conflict problem. And what it is that the way TCP/IP works is that every machine on the network actually gets assigned an IP address or self-assigns an IP address. And those IP addresses have to be unique to that network. And normally at a home network, it starts with 192 or 10 and then three other sets of numbers with dots in between. In any case, what's happening right now for you is that the machine that you're turning on and then it gives you the error actually has the same IP address assigned as another machine in your network. And once it comes online, those two machines just have complete failures to communicate because they are going to respond and talk with IP addresses that are the same. And it's equivalent to you having a Laurel and Hardy type of comedy routine where you're talking to two people named Miles. And they're going to both answer you, and you're going to be having two conversations at the same time, and no one's going to get anywhere, but eventually you'll start laughing. Unfortunately, computers aren't humorous, and so they never laugh. They just give up error messages. So what you need to do is actually go into the network configurations of all these machines and figure out why the IP addresses are the same. There's two possible reasons. One is more unlikely, and the more unlikely one is that you're using a thing called DHCP, and that service is broken. And I don't think that's really likely, but if my next suggestion is not the case, then it's that problem, and then you've got a little more of a serious issue. But the simpler one is probably that your machines have been set up with static IP addresses, or at least one of them has. And what that means is that if you look at the network settings, it's going to say what the IP address is, and it's going to be typed in, and it's not going to be getting it from DHCP. And if that's the case, you just need to make the last number in that four sets of numbers, mean to make them unique, and just change it and save it and restart the machines, and you're set. Now, you're on Windows?
Yeah, XP.
Okay, so all these machines are XP. So this is the way you get to the settings. You go. Okay. The simplest way to do it is to open up your control panel and open up networking on each of these machines. And in one of the networking dialogs areas, I don't have a Windows machine in front of me, so I can't actually give you the exact direct path. But, in fact, are there any Windows machines here? No? Anybody want to open up Parallels?
Nobody likes Windows.
Well, no, we all love Windows. It's great. So you're going to be opening up the networking control, and you're going to see a card or controller that represents your network. You open up that, and you show the properties of that. And inside there, you're going to have a TCP/IP area. Open that TCP/IP area, and you're going to see whether it's DHCP or hard-coded. Take a look at all four of these machines. Just go and open up all three of these machines at once, and take a look at what's in there and see which ones are DHCP and which ones are static. And if the ones that are working that you haven't turned on yet, the ones that you're going to turn one on, if any of the machines are static and the other ones aren't, you've got to kind of change it. So basically, what you need to do is make them all DHCP or all static, but with different IP addresses. And that's it. Those are the last digits of the IP address.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
And pretty much. I didn't think any of them were static because I thought that you were supposed to have an IP that got assigned every time you turned on.
Right. Well, if it's DHCP, you're supposed to get a unique IP address. The next thing that could potentially be happening, and this is when I was talking about it being more complicated, is that it is possible for a DHCP service to actually assign the same IP address to two different machines. That means the service is failing. But there's one way that it could fail pretty easily, and that is there's actually a way at a deeper level for the machines to tell each other apart, and that's called a MAC address, not to be confused with Macintoshes. MAC, and it's possible that two of your machines have the same MAC address, which would really only happen if you got these machines from a manufacturing company as
Dell. They're both Dell.
Now, that's probably not the case then. Miles?
It's not just DHCP failing. If you have a machine with a static IP on there, then the DHCP server doesn't know anything about it and simply will allocate a block of IP addresses. It doesn't actually, most of them don't actually look at to see if the IP address is already taken. They are just told to allocate a certain range. And then if you put a machine on there that's a static IP, that's going to mess up the works.
Yeah.
Would that explain randomness? In that it doesn't always happen.
Yeah, what's probably going on is that two of your machines are DHCP and one of your machines is static. And so sometimes one of those other machines will actually get assigned the IP address that the static machine is always getting. And so anytime you have a conflict like that, that's when it pops up. So it might not show up for a while, and then it would start showing up.
So if I just make sure all of them are static, it ought to be...
I would try to switch them all to DHCP. personally. The okay. next thing is, where are you getting your DHCP? And that's the next question in your network area. Do you have a router?
Yeah.
Okay, so the router is actually doing the DHCP. If you can go into the administration console of the router and take a look what's going on there, it's possible that your router is supposed to only give out two IP addresses and keep looping through those two. And then you've got a little bit of a problem. It also has its DHCP server settings is going to tell you what range of IP addresses to give out. And what you can do is take a look at that range and see if there's like, you know, if it starts at 10.10, then go ahead and assign your static one to .5 and they'll never get conflicts. I think that's enough for that on air, but you're welcome to, if assuming you can get on the network, you're welcome to go to the forums and say, I tried this or I tried that, and we can give you some images and stuff to kind of show you where to do things. All right, thank you for the call.
Okay, I will experiment. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That just reminds me how easy Windows networking is.
I love the,
okay,
the control panels,
properties, and then the TCP/IP, the properties on that, and then you look into it.
Who do we have next, Ben?
Mardine from Ben Lomond.
Hey, that's my hometown. I grew up there. Hey, Mardine, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello.
What's your question?
Well, I was interested in the Wii music that you were talking about earlier. I want to know more about the game. What's the object of it, and how is it played?
Who's played it?
The Wikipedia article says it's an upcoming music video game for the Wii that simulates playing musical instruments using the Wii remote and the Wii balance board.
So no one's played it yet.
Well, except for the guy who designed it. It's supposed to be
released.
You know,
I heard
October
that he was really
16th.
Into music, and that's actually why he did that. His hobby was getting into music.
Huh.
So October 16th, Miles?
Mm-hmm.
All right, so you got a month. Or
so
2 months.
It isn't out yet, but It's
probably a lot like, what are those other ones
Guitar
called?
Guitar Hero.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Guitar with other Hero. Instruments?
Well, probably with just the Wii remote and some other, you know, virtual representation.
You can
but
find some screenshots available online if you want to take a glimpse at kind of what the
probably,
interface would be.
And probably a YouTube video if you did a search for it.
So what is the balance board, like a whammy bar?
Maybe. What's the game called again?
Wii Music.
Wii Music. Thank you very much for the call.
Well, I wanted to ask something else, actually.
Okay, this time.
I have had the idea for a long time that it would be really cool to incorporate instruments, actual instruments, into a video game so that you could put a pickup on, say, a guitar and play and try to, you know, hit the notes correctly in order to advance in the game.
Right.
And I just, you know, as a person who has no access to designing video games, I'm wondering if there's any way that kind of an idea could be presented to a video game manufacturer.
Well, funny that you should ask. My day job is working for a program called Digital Arts New Media up at UCSC, and one of our just graduating alumni, his name is Mark Scipolioni, I think is how you pronounce his last name. He had a project which is exactly that. He took old Nintendo games and actually hacked the Nintendo games to then allow different types of audio input. And a pretty amazing project. He was actually able to play keyboards and play Super Mario Brothers by making the game system understand the style that he was playing. So if he took the keyboard and went up the keyboard with kind of a rolling keystroke, the character would move forward. And if he wanted to slow him up or back him up, he had to go down the keyboard. And then high, I think atonal sounds would cause a jump. It was pretty impressive. And then he also did other things where it was just volume or just frequency and kind of a slower range. The keyboard one, of course, was MIDI. So there is some development being done, but we are in this amazing dawn of new game developments happening all the time.
I would, not to put a damper on all of it, but I would worry about trying to get it to an established game manufacturer because there's a limited audience, people who can actually play music effectively.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also have to, as opposed to most controllers, which is like Guitar Hero's four buttons with the
eight
little...
Buttons. Okay. Four on the bottom, four on the top.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes. And this is going to be, instead of just taking input from eight buttons, it would be, okay, take the input that's coming in as sound, then try to do an analysis on it, and then try to figure out what has been pressed.
There'd be latency issues. You'd have to find ways around. Yeah, I think so.
Latency or just
I mean, a little bit of latency between when you pluck the string and when the system is able to do the processing to know that you hit the successful note.
Well, I know like on American Idol, you know, you have a microphone and it has a pitch. It can identify whether you're close to the pitch or not. and that's pretty instantaneous.
True. They also have
a bigger budget than most.
They also have very, very specific hardware that only does that. It's kind of like chroma keying, which is taking out the green or the blue on a blue or green screen. Mm-hmm. So like the television newscasters have a box which only does that, and that's why they can do it in real time and so well. But if you try to make a game console do something like real time pitch recognition, everything, it would be, I think, pretty different.
It might work if the guitar was sold with the game and it was always the same model, same make, and it was always a guitar. Mm-hmm. I could see that.
But I really like that idea because, with Guitar Hero, you're not actually learning how to play the guitar.
Right.
You only have, effectively one string. And so, it could kind of push people to take up the actual hobbies of playing real music instead of.
Yeah.
And then similarly, also, you could play different notes with different fingerings. I mean, almost all instruments have multiple fingerings for many of the notes, and guitar certainly.
Mardian, thank you very much for the call.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Oh, and another thing, make sure you don't tell anyone else your idea.
Oh, yeah, that was a great story. Where did I hear that story? Did you hear about this? Okay. We talked about it last week or something, or I've been reading about it, but the idea, it's this blog post I made on GeekSpeak. That's right. If you take a look at the GeekSpeak blog, there's actually some posts, and recently I made I can't remember what. In any case, the idea is that an idea without execution is worth about nothing. There's this great blog entry that talks about how you figure out if an idea is worth something. So a really good idea is worth $10, and then the execution actually gives you a multiplier. So if you do no execution, it's always just worth $10. It doesn't matter. And
if you do no execution, it's zero. Because
I guess
zero times anything is
okay.
Be
so maybe, yeah. So you have to do some kind of execution. I think the base level was $10. So maybe it was zero execution equals one. So the idea that trying to make sign an NDA or make protecting your idea, don't do that. Share your idea. Maybe someone else will do it. Or share your idea and someone will be interested and you'll participate with them. But the idea that just an idea has a lot of value is, in my mind, kind of fictitious. Okay, from Watsonville, Ron, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've got an iMac, and I'll never be able to type more than 60 words a minute in my lifetime. So I invested in Mac Speech Dictate, because I can talk a lot faster than I can type. And I love it, but what I don't like is the little headset microphone thing that came with it. It's kind of cheap and cheesy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, and I did a little research online trying to find out if there were, some alternatives that where I wouldn't be tethered to the computer all the time with the headset. But they, for my budget, they were really prohibitively expensive. So
really?
I'm wondering if you know of any kind of microphone headset thing out there that would be compatible with Mac Speech Dictate that wouldn't break the bank.
Well, any Bluetooth enabled headset has microphone on it will work on OS X, but OS X's audio stuff is really just weak. Like, it keeps on not being so good. So I do have a Plantronics headset. I wish I remembered the name of it. I think it's a 260, but it's a Bluetooth Plantronics headset, but I think it's over $100, and that does give you a microphone that's remote from your laptop of, 10 feet or so.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody else have a recommendation on getting one of these? Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are expensive. There's just it's a higher end market a little bit. I think $100 price point is what you're kind of aiming for.
Are you looking for only wireless?
Because I do my best thinking when I'm walking around here rather than just sitting. And then just, when I'm doing research and I have to reach for something and a microphone is falling off my head. And
sure.
It's really a drag. But even 100 is better than some of the ones that I saw listed online, which were up in the $300, $400 range.
Yeah, I think there's definitely pricier ones, but I kind of think that someone should be making one of these for about that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'd agree with that.
So, the Bluetooth? Plantronics is the one, or one of their...
Plantronics is one of the major headset manufacturers. Yeah. They happen to be a Santa Cruz company, too, by the way.
Well, they came. I mean, that's what came with it, is a Plantronics, but it's just kind of cheap. And again, it isn't, it's tethered to the...
What is the cheapness factor for you? Is it the audio quality of the of what it's able to capture, or the build material?
Well, it doesn't hold on to you. You know, it's not much to hold it on your head. So, like, you know, if you turn and there's a pull on the cord, all right. of a sudden the thing's falling off.
The Bluetooth ones don't have wires going to the computer. So that is one set of it. And there are headphones that are Bluetooth. Mm-hmm. You know, I would look for, I do a search on Google for, under products, there's a Google search thing that's actually for product searching, and look for wireless headset microphone. I don't know, what do you call them when they have a microphone? Just look for wireless headsets.
Bluetooth microphone?
Not just Bluetooth, because there's sometimes, there might be one that's cheaper that's not Bluetooth that could be better.
Yeah.
Then but then again, you're going to run into a situation where it's almost Windows always.
Do you have a laptop?
No.
No? Okay. Never mind then. Yeah. Well, I was going to say if it's a wireless USB thing, then you'll have a dongle that you have to plug in every time. If you have a laptop, that'd be a big deal. But
thank you very much for the call.
All right, thanks you guys.
All right, bye bye. I think that's all the calls we're going to be taking today. So thank you very much for participating via phone. I really appreciate it. You're always welcome to ask us questions on the GeekSpeak forums. We're there all the time helping people out. That's at forums.geekspeak.org. And, of course, you can just get to it from geekspeak.org. One more news story as we close off the show, a brief one. Someone didn't get to something they wanted to mention. Blank faces, scouring back. Miles.
Sure, there's... There is something I came across just before the show, and putting a link up on the website for people to see this as an example of what not to do. It's an ad that has been found on the internet. It was asking the question, has your credit card number been stolen on the internet? And by doing that, what it's doing is it's providing an input box where you input your card number and your expiration date and says, check it. If you fill this in...
You are bad.
Your credit card number has just been stolen on the internet.
So it's an ad saying, have you done it? And then it asks you for it.
Yes.
So if you're concerned that your credit card might be stolen, you can assure that your credit card's been stolen with a click of a button.
Yeah.
Please don't share your credit card unless the company's a trustworthy company. Oh, no.
Hey, the price of freedom is eternal vigilance. The price of identity theft is eternal gullibility.
That was Miles Elam, political junkie and social activist geek. We also had writer Brooks and Ben Jaffe. My name is Lyle Troxell. Answering the phone, as he does every week for years with almost no thanks, is Rick Philman. Rick, thank you so much for being here every week to make GeekSpeak what it is. Without you, it would just be us talking to ourselves, and no one wants to listen to that. You can hear two concerts from the Cabrillo Music Festival of Contemporary Music this weekend. Today at 11, that's like now, there will be a family concert with music by Hidgen and Daugherty. And tomorrow at 11, there's going to be lots of stuff from Cabrillo. So please stay tuned for GeekSpeak for Castle Cottage in just a moment. Broadcasting on HD Radio on 80.9 FM. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Auto, streaming live and podcasting at KUSP.org. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of online tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission.